Hello, creeps. I'll be your ghost. I mean host. As we delve the crypts of spooky movies and even spookier theory, welcome to Horror Vanguard.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Horror Vanguard. I am one of your ghosts, Ashley Darrow, joined as always, now and forever, by John, aka the Liquor Guy, and Kyle Kern. How is it going, everyone?
I like that you say, like, forever. Sort of like the HV Crypt is akin to the Hotel California. You can. Once you've checked in, baby.
We're living it up in the Horror Vanguard. It's such a lovely place.
I have my list of questions for God and enough cocaine to kill a small army. I am ready to talk about Joel Schumacher.
So, Kyle, in a way, you're like most fans of the band The Eagles.
Precisely.
I have a lot of, like, Art Deco architecture and, like, neoclassical paintings of, like, naked Greek gods, and of course a defibrillator, and I think we're ready, we're prepared, we're ready to podcast.
It's time to be heterosexual.
That's every time I watch a Schumacher movie, I'm like, this is a straight cisgendered movie for people who don't like to fuck.
There's nothing. This is just guys being dudes. Mm-hmm. This is just. Fellas, is it gay to be so desirous of the infinite that you want to meet God to the point of self-annihilation until Kiefer Sutherland will kiss you on the mouth? I don't think so.
Oh, if I only could make a deal with God.
Yeah, I've read the Bible. None of that's in there, so we're good.
Really? There's not a section in the Bible about making a deal with God so he gives you injectable estrogen so you can start to look like Julia Roberts? I thought that was in the book, based on my understanding from this movie exclusively.
Gosh, no, it's amazing. She okay, looks good. She looks just like she had to be the only woman in this.
Yes.
Like, she was woman, you know, like, as an idea. Like, she... it was like... She's looked amazing. I am as gay as the day is long. And probably because of that reason, I'm just like, she looks amazing.
Yeah, I too would like Julia Roberts to come over and watch me sleep. And I too would like to do nothing more than just protect her and tell her yes. How beautiful she is.
You are too pretty to die. And then come back to life and then maybe die again. It's just not, it's not in the cards for you.
Like Kevin Bacon, I respect women so much in this.
Yeah, there's really nothing about Kiefer Sutherland, Kevin Bacon, and Julia Roberts strapped to a table with a bunch of random shocking electrodes all over the body that makes me feel anything. You know, I don't get the appeal of that in the slightest. It's no way that I didn't stay awake in a fever sweat for the entire night because of those sequences. That didn't happen to me.
Being placed under illuminating bright lights as if you're on observation and completely out of control. Very unsexed context.
Yeah, it's very chaste, this film. It's very chaste. But perhaps, you know, contextually, listeners may have worked out what it is we're talking about, but I doubt it. we are so privileged to talk about just extremely beautiful men from the early 1990s and Joel Schumacher's the icon of American queer cinema. Joel Schumacher's film, Flatliners. And I am beside myself with just sheer libidinal pleasure in asking Ash to explain to me, to you, to Kyle, to everyone listening, to Joel Schumacher himself, because we know he listens to the show. What Flatliners from 1990 is about.
Well, today is a good day to die. The weather would be pleasant if it wasn't for the rain. You're on the coast of Liguria in the fall, mid-1400s. A small boy runs up to you peddling cheese. He's the son of a wool weaver based on his clothes. You catch an odd look in his eyes. Not the usual merchant's son, he's curious, but you've no time for shopping. You're in the city on official business. Your mind starts to wander. Maybe I'll come back to the market and do some shopping tomorrow. I wonder what this boy is going to make of his future. Some cheese and wine would be so refreshing on a day like this. You're snapped out of your reverie by the feeling of your clothes getting damp in the rain. It's time to move on. You never return to that market, but in a few short decades, that curious weaver's son will have spread plagues, slavery, and genocide to the Americas. Everything matters. Everything we do matters. 400 years later, Chicago plays host to the World's Columbian Exhibition. Among its more notable attractions were the first commercial movie theater, the original Ferris wheel, and the first moving walkway. And, of course, a very liberal whitewashing of genocide. Long before the Chicago World's Fair, a man of African and Haitian descent, Jean-Baptiste Dusable, became the founder of Chicago, though he still goes largely uncredited to this day. Just a few short years after Dusable makes his home on the banks of the Chicago River, a successful insurrection will ignite the liberation of Haiti. All the while, for a long time before that and to this very day, this land was home to Potawatomi, Miami, Sauk, and Fox peoples. Near the lakeside terminus of the Chicago Riverwalk, a mural by Ojibwe artist Andrea Carlson reads, "You are on Potawatomi land." The best view of the mural is either from the Dusable Bridge above, or while shopping at Chicago's flagship Apple Store on the other side of the river. Roughly 100 years before Carlson painted her powerful, damning mural, and slightly fewer than 100 years since the opening of the Apple Michigan Avenue store, the newly founded Federal Housing Administration hired one Homer Hoyt as chief economist. Hey, fellatio, got a match? Well, I do. You're facing my ass. Hoyt was chosen due to the popularity of his recently published dissertation, which jumbled bunk racist caliper nonsense with empty-headed economic gestures. Today we call his economic innovation redlining. Hoyt's redlining was pioneered in Chicago, but quickly spread throughout the country, decimating communities of color as it went. The general candor of the first few hundred years of Chicagoan life begins to take on a strange, dyschronic resemblance. Our sins have come back in physical form, and they're pissed. In the same year as Martin Luther King Jr. and JFK were assassinated, the Democratic National Convention was held in Chicago. Amidst the unrest of the civil rights movement and the war in Vietnam, the stage for massive national protests was set. Despite tensions between activists and police, protests were largely without violence until the police charged into protesters and beat a man for lowering an American flag. Shortly after, chants of "Hell no, we won't go" could be heard through the streets as a Viet Cong flag hung over a city fighting to stay on its knees. In 2024, the DNC is set to return to Chicago in a political climate oddly similar. As familiar as it was in 1968, as familiar as it was in so many years prior, like a skipped stone refusing to finally just fucking sink. "I'm sorry we trespassed on your fucking territory, God. I'm sorry. Isn't that enough?" Chicago is the city of flatliners. There's a hum beneath the traffic on 94, like a dragging just under the glow of streetlights. It's the slow rattling of a specter bound in chain, crying out for absolution, giving us the chance at atonement. The city of flatliners. Once you cross that line, you either work to see the day of forgiveness or join their ranks in time. It's all on life here, all bitten, all chewed, and God, so desperately hungry. Can you hear that? Just below the lake, the sound in the woods that used to be, there's a vibrant, living electric hum. 369, the goose drank wine, the monkey chewed tobacco on the streetcar line. The line broke, the monkey got smoked, and they all went to heaven in a little rowboat. Clap, clap. Join us as we discuss Flatliners.
Where are we also thinking that the weather underground were flatliners?
Oh, absolutely.
I think that's, if I took away anything from this week's Precy, it was that the weather underground were flatliners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's the only reasonable conclusion. Well, now that I've had a little bit of fun, let's jump into the formalism zone. John, I'm going to need you to lie down on this table and let Kyle and I inject you with stuff.
Oh, we call that podcasting, baby.
Yeah, we all take turns.
Come on. Let's be honest. Everyone takes turns. There's a lot of arguments over timing. It sometimes involves drugs and electricity. This is a movie about making a podcast.
Where do you think the Precies come from? How do you think I write these? I have to go have a little meeting with the divine every night.
Yeah, God writes them. We are just the messengers. Put on my best youth pastor, turn around my hat, put on my best youth pastor voice and talk about how God is the real, is really like a podcaster when you think about it.
Whoa, kids. Do you want to know a Patreon that's really cool to subscribe to?
Are you
looking for the most exclusive content you can get in this world and the next? that was either a Patreon plug or a continuation of the youth pastor bit. I'll leave that up to the audience to decide whether you want to take that one.
It's always a Patreon plug, patreon.com
/horrorvanguard. If you'd like to decide, go to horrorvanguard.com and vote now by clicking on the link to regularly give us money every month.
Yep.
New Patreon stretch goal. We will tell you what happens in the afterlife if we get enough money.
We will hire Julia Roberts to do the flatlining experiments on all of us.
Yes.
And bring back messages from the great beyond.
Okay, that's just implied on the Patreon now. I know that there aren't goals anymore, but that's just on there now. We will start flatlining ourselves if enough people give enough money to this show. I'm down. Let's just call it right there. That's a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll be famous. We'll be on 60 Minutes.
We'll be on 60 Minutes. 60
Minutes. Hello, Barbara Walters. Do you hear me?
Should we just take a moment to appreciate the as I said, the icon of like mainstream American cinema that is the extremely, extremely not heterosexual Joel Schumacher?
If you go to his Wikipedia page, the picture of him is the oiliest, like wettest photo of a person I've ever seen, which is so perfect. It's just like,
he is glistening.
It's just like the horniest person exists, and his name is Joel Schumacher. We made note of it before we started recording, but the main takeaway that I had from this movie is that no one say that cocaine never gave us never did any good for the world. I don't think that point stands so much anymore. And also you can get some real magic out of a movie if you're willing to do enough cocaine to turn Batman gay. Because when you do, sometimes you just have, I don't know, maybe the best idea ever for a movie. in this case, I don't know.
And if that's not enough, you also go on to make The Lost Boys. Like
Schumacher.
What an icon. Just iconic on every, like, costume designer, trained at the Parsons School. It spent enough time doing cocaine to tell George Clooney that actually Batman's gay, as if that was a mystery to anybody. made St. Elmo's Fire, understood that mm-hmm. Kiefer Sutherland in the late 80s and early 90s was untouchably attractive.
St. Elmo's Fire was a thing for me when I was younger.
Mm-hmm. Formative. We call that a formative aesthetic experience. Yeah.
the man's got taste. What can we say?
And then we get this, which I love this movie because it's so deeply strange. Why don't we just throw in a whole bunch of weird metaphysical speculation about the nature of death whilst we're admiring Kevin Bacon, whilst we are filming it mostly at Loyola University. Ash, I need a digression here on Chicago cinema.
I mean, God, there's so much to say about how this movie kind of constructs the identity of Chicago. Often when Chicago appears in cinema, it appears in the form of a disarticulated portion of New York, or part of the, like, when we want to construct the, like, false facade of, like, a gothic metropolis, we'll graft part of, like, we'll take, like, a grimier, rundown part of New York, we'll graft that onto some Victorian architecture shot in London, and then we'll piece the whole thing together with a chunk of Chicago.
The second city, and I think this right?
Yeah. And I think this movie, in a way that I found to be very, like, open and, like, very honest, like, explores Chicago as not just the Loop, right? Not just those nice parts of downtown that look good on camera. And, like, the one part of Chicago, the one, like nice part of Chicago that we see here, the Museum of Science and Industry, right? And the Loyola campus, right? Those are dressed down. Those are dressed down to look so greasy and terrible and run down and abandoned. So in a way, like I've been, you know, like I frequent a lot of the neighborhoods that were shot in this, right? And I've gone to visit a lot of these locations, and now they're all like, you couldn't shoot this movie there today because they're all gentrified, and there's like a big neon sign that's like Bubbles Pet Therapy or something, like just some weird, like the kind of shops you only see in a neighborhood where the rent just went up by like 1,000%.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I artisanal love that boba.
Like, yeah. I love that in this movie, there's no such thing as just daytime in Chicago. Like, Chicago,
which is true,
permanently lit by like orange sodium light, and like just beautifully photographed decaying neo-Gothic architecture. It's amazing.
The opening shot of the movie is they did it in front of a building that was under construction. That's what's so like, that building's done now. But like, you see all of this, like it's shot out like over the lake and then approaches from, it does a lot of this, like, and it's a shot that's later mimicked, in one of the first death sequence, actually, when he's running through the field. They come into that sequence in that same sort of like very, very, very ultra wide, kind of like helicopter shot thing. And yeah, it's never daytime. And then they use the same glow to talk about touching between when the planes in the movie start to merge together about halfway through. They use that color as a nod to that, and I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, in a way, maybe the flatlining is some kind of, like, I don't know, already experienced material condition. Maybe that's something that this movie's trying to get across. I don't know. I don't think that could be the case, though.
No, sounds too deep.
Too deep. No, this movie's just about being, like, furiously horny.
Yeah, furiously horny, and also very depressed.
Yeah.
I do really appreciate how this captures, like, there's always like this weird precarity in Chicago, right? Like, there are so many cities that could have been Chicago, right? Like, there are so many other like Great Lakes port cities that could have kind of held the title that Chicago now holds if it wasn't for a few like quirks of history that just wound up dropping all of that money here and turning this into like the port hub and now the finance hub of the region. And this movie really like kind of doesn't shy away from that, because there's either the impulse to like present Chicago as quote unquote Chi-Rack, right? The most violent place in the United States, which is just like a right-wing lie. It's just untrue on like every way of measuring that. It's a lie. Yeah. Or to present Chicago as like a glistening bastion of finance or architecture or like something, all these other things, which are like, that was true of Chicago 100 years ago, you know, but since we've desperately let go of that, now Chicago is kind of the home of that legacy and nothing more. Like, this is, in I think a very important respect, like one of the few movies that actually captures Chicago's status as being a legitimate ghost city. Not in the sense of like the Wild West ghost town that is abandoned, but in a city of ghosts.
Cincinnati's really similar and yep. took some of that heat in the sort of in the move toward the interior as St. Louis. And I think the real takeaway, my most serious takeaway from the Precy is what you're both kind of pointing directly to, which is that the historicizing reveals this like very, very rich constellation of that of historical stuff that moves across the period to where Chicago has now this like, you know, it wears 10 different masks of a version of itself, and it's up to us to kind of try and peel that back. And culture does that really well because it imagines it rather than reflects it at just or reflects it thusly or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So how about those Jesuits? Is a lead-in for a point that I know so little about. You two, please take this away ridiculous.
You pointed out this is filmed at Loyola University. A private Jesuit founded university in Chicago. I'm guessing a lot of the murals and things are just part of like the infrastructure of the place, part of the fabric of campus.
Yeah.
And like this is for people like, oh, it's Joel Schumacher. Yeah, there's a lot of like religion in this movie. This is a very spiritually inclined film, and I just think it's interesting that it's done. Like, we can get into this maybe, but like the fact that it's filmed at a place which is founded as a Catholic university, and is very much about this notion of experiences of the beyond, like essentially ecstatic religious visions, yes, that turn out to be coming true, is again, it's probably a coincidence. It's no subtext intended here at all. What do you think, Kyle?
Yeah, I think surely this movie could not be that smart. As to the, I think that it sums it up, and a lot of those exterior shots are of the Madonna della Strada, the Catholic parish, a Jesuit parish that's on campus at Loyola, which is an Art Deco. It was that building itself sort of like gestures toward divinity like churches do in the typical way, but is decidedly an Art Deco style. It was designed and built in the 1920s and 30s. I think that's just remarkable. A remarkable way of sort of like bringing this realm of divinity in conversation with characters who are very, in a lot of places, very plainly stating their rigid interpretation of metaphysics. Yeah, their indebtedness to an epistemology grounded in an absolute scientific view of the world, something that's probably extremely common among med students. I would say that like in very extremely common among scientists in general. And the idea that there could be something horrific that lies beyond the structure, the fundamental structure of knowledge. The line that I wrote down from the beginning of the movie is, when did truth and knowledge become a horror? Always have been.
Mm-hmm. Always has been. That's always right. Has been.
It is. It like
the line that I wrote down, because I wrote down that one as well. But the other one I wrote down is like, there's a moment where one of them says that, oh, like philosophy and religion have failed. It's time for like science to get at the truth. And I'm like, let's dig into those metaphysical assumptions.
And I think what you both just pointed out, like those two lines are especially powerful in the context of how Chicago is often represented in cinema, right? Because the kind of This is a city that is deeply preoccupied with the struggle over the soul, right? One of the things that's left out of this movie, I mean, not, I shouldn't say left out as like as if a movie could contain everything, but one of the things that's like, you know, just off stage is the fact that, like, you know, atomic weaponry were first conceived in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the city that birthed the necessary, like, structures for the atomic bomb. And I think, like, this is the city where the struggle between, like, science and the human soul fights on, like, a very deep historic level.
You talked about 1968 and the DNC and the, like, incredible amount of violence that came from protesting the DNC and the police violence and all of the stuff that spurred off from that moment. And I brought up the Weather Underground specifically, which were galvanized through SDS and then through the DNC in 1968. All of that sort of culminating in the, like, reaction to the technological changes in warfare from the Vietnam War, which was a big part of the way the sort of shift, which was the sort of like the shift that came from the event in the same way World War One did that. As that change is more popularly understood, then a sort of oppositional force comes and rises in an attempt to address that. And eventually that force started building bombs and a lot of people started setting themselves on fire. They had been doing that since 1960, but, it's like, I don't know, like, you know, the guiding hand of theology stays winning, I guess, is my my sort of Benjaminian assertion.
Maybe there might be like an analogy that we could make here of like a puppet and a dwarf, or like a mechanical engine of some form that is like controlling. Like a chess game.
Uh-huh. It can play Mario Party, right? Yeah. It can play Mario Party, and it's really good.
You're talking about a TAS. You're talking about a tool-assisted speedrun.
Yeah.
And this is not to like reinscribe the necessity of some sort of like transcendental higher order, but simply to point out that like, capitalism has a political theology implicit in it, which is like profoundly annihilationist, like profoundly, because the life of like life is this kind of like disposable asset class. And I think to understand flatliners as within this kind of like okay. If you want to understand this movie, you have to read Atheism and Christianity. because this is Bloch's whole point, is that like the whole point of the theological project is that not only is it co-opted by the forces of capitalism, but actually that it possesses a kind of liberatory content that doesn't depend upon this idea of like the transcendent beyond. Like Kevin Bacon's character is insistent that he's an atheist, right? And Bloch says famously, only an atheist can be a good Christian, and only a Christian can be a good atheist. Are you interested in the metaphysical like stakes of our current political situation? You automatically end up talking about theology, whether you like it or not.
And this is a struggle that's like geographically extant in the film, right? Like the University of Chicago is so absent from this movie, right? Chicago's flagship school, one of the best in the country, if not the world. Also the home of the Chicago School, which has been responsible for like a level of genocide and global death and pain and suffering that like has not been seen in ages, right? Just truly a seat of the world's evil. And this movie counterposes that with, like, you know, the Jesuit school, the theological thing, which certainly has produced its own evils, but, like, nowhere near the scale of, like, the rigid materialism that came out of the Chicago school.
Yeah, all of that's sort of, like, born in the Chicago school, the architectural Chicago school stuff that acts as the, that's the sort of scaffolding It is like, you know, it is a movie that knows, Joel Schumacher knows how to sexualize a building, I think is the, like, he yes. really, like,
yes,
he's horny for buildings, too, and not in a, and in the perfect Joel Schumacher way, not in this neat, tidy, sanitized, ordinary, but in the angular, the unfinished, the rough-edged, the, like, he knows how to peer up to a building. There's a shot toward the end where I think it's when they're all trying to find him after he's decided to solo flatline, which is, as they all pretty much point out in the movie, not a thing. That's just dying. but he's maybe having something of a break and having some difficulty that's not allowing him to see that you can't solo flatline. That's not a thing. But I think it's when the other guys pull up and they pan up to, there's a shot of Julia Roberts where she's standing against the building and they pan up to, I took a screenshot of it because it was really impactful. I'll drop it in. You know what? I'll be a good podcaster and I will, if I can go fast enough, I think I can drop it into the group chat. Because there's a, oh yeah, there's a couple of building pictures. There's the Halloween party. For example, which has this sort of like sinister distance to it, there, and then there is this, yes, this right here, this shot of Julia Roberts, I thought was really powerful. Mm-hmm. She's standing up, but she like she's really like a part of the architecture of the building in this particular scene, and the way that a church and a religious university, its buildings and its architecture are used as this sort of like aesthetic projection of modernity rather than as this, as modernity as this sort of like covering up of the theological nature or whatever, which is the reactionary position. And the material position is illustrated so beautifully. And it's so, in such a challenging kind of like, it challenges, the premise of the movie is being challenged as the characters are working through the, you know, it just has all of this really juicy stuff to it.
And both of those building shots are like paintings out of like a classic Gothic novel play. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. The thing that's so like fascinating about this film is because, Joel Schumacher is horny for buildings, but is also deeply horny for Kiefer Sutherland. Understandably so. And yeah. In some ways, when you watch the movie, you recognize that you're watching something that could only have been made in the years between 1988 and 1993. It could only exist in that specific brief flickering window of possibility. But also, like, this idea of, like, beautiful, sad boys experimenting with death and the women who hang around in churches that love them is the, like, the foundational stuff of like, the American Gothic tradition going back to, like, Edgar Allan Poe and Charles Brockden Brown and Nathaniel Hawthorne and, like, this is so, like, quintessentially pure, uncut Gothic cinema. As well as being at the same time, just so 1990.
Yep. You described it
absolutely.
You described it perfectly. Ash, you go.
Oh no, I was just going to lead us into our next point, but you go on if you got something.
Oh no, just that like that's it is it's goth in this unifying sense of the terminology. Like it feels so like of its contemporary period. The music is something that I think illustrates that really well. As a part of the show now, I get to bring fun facts, and my fun fact is that James Newton Howard, the composer for this movie, composed the theme for the television program ER.
That is a fun fact.
Isn't that fun? Good. See, I love the one of my favorite scenes in the movie is the first time that they successfully flatline. After that, there's a song that's playing that's apparently titled "We Did It," which I love. I saw that. I'm like, yes, it is. It's 40 seconds long. It's called We Did It. And it is just like, it's a shot of them. And that is the first, that's one of the only glints of, there's no real daylight in it, but it's one of the only like gestures toward daylight because they successfully flatlined. So they're walking around as the sun is coming up. And it has this very like, if you hear it and you watch Twin Peaks, you'll recognize the sort of late 80s, like 90s melodramatic synth with the high end, like kind of Fender Telecaster kind of, you know, guitar sound on it. It's just very like, I don't know. We're going to go. Okay. That's, yeah. I'm trying to be more. I'm trying to behave less like a guest and more like a listener, dear listener. I know that I ramble, so I'm trying to be better about it.
But there's two things. There's two things that, like, a little inside baseball for you HV listeners, and for Kyle, is that, like, one, we do plan what we're going to talk about, and two, everybody loves the Labour Kyle tangent. Like, that we need to keep those, otherwise everyone's going to be real mad at us.
whatever the listener, I am strapped to a table currently in the depths of my childhood traumatic experiences and relying on the listeners and my co-host to bring me back to life. So whatever anybody needs.
Do you want to talk about should we talk about like the secret arcane horror that is truth and knowledge in an age of scientific inquiry?
I would love for us to discuss this subject. And in no way is this also like, because I think what I hope we're successfully getting across here is everything in a Schumacher movie is horny beyond recognition.
Yes.
You know, and like this movie features Kevin Bacon and Kiefer Sutherland locking lips.
Yep.
And it's like, There's a beautiful, there's something like I would say sublime in the appropriate Gothic study sense of that to this. There is kind of a leveling spiritual recognition that comes with this. Like I do remember watching this movie in like my early teens and being like, huh, are there some thoughts? There's some things to consider in this film. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's kindness to the way that they like they're always checking in on each other, like, yes, with instruments, and like that was nice.
It's about compassion.
Yeah
like Joel Schumacher gets it. Like sometimes you just gotta give your homies a little kiss. It's okay.
Yeah, kiss the homies goodnight.
It's okay if it, like, and it's fine, and it's good that gives you feelings that you don't really have words for. That's fine. Don't worry about it.
It's about having impactful experiences.
You can work it out.
Listen. In college, didn't we all experiment with the border between life and death and God's untouchable domain? I think we've all been there.
Yeah, you got together with your buddies and you experienced something that forever changed all of you, from which you can never come back.
Yeah, seriously, you're just like at a party and you see some guy and you're like, hey, cool hat, man. Do you ever like consider experimenting with the edge of death?
If we're talking about if the edge of death is making out with another man, then I've basically done that. I've used that exact move, and it has worked.
Oh, yeah, I think you and I once had like an hour-long conversation about the cool hat technique.
Yeah, that's what I always said. It's always sussed them out. Is it, you just be real casual and chill, and then sometimes they'll just make out with you. You can be surprised.
Sometimes
you spin the wheel,
yeah. Yeah, sometimes they'll make out with you. Sometimes they'll give you an injection of sodium pentothal.
Mm-hmm.
It is really exactly like the experience of flatlining, because sometimes you have this really positive experience that's mutually healing and beneficial. Mm-hmm. Other times someone is about to freak out, get violent, and all of a sudden have like this upsurging of feelings they don't know what to do about, that are all pent up about some experience they had when they were a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're literally going to get stalked by the demons of your childhood. That are going to yell. A lot of getting attacked by kids. We mentioned that, I think. But I was watching the movie. My spouse was working, but he was kind of like peering up nearby, and he had never seen it before. And he looked up at one point while Kiefer Sutherland was being attacked by the child. I think this is when someone spit into someone else's mouth. Again, another thing that happened in this very not horny movie. And he started laughing and he said, "Sorry, I keep looking up and it's that kid attacking him. I'm not paying attention." But he would look up and then there would be another attacking scene, which I thought was really funny.
Yeah, this movie is great if you want to see Kiefer Sutherland regularly getting his shit rocked by a child.
A child that may or may not exist. And I think the nature of everyone's encounter with either the divine or these deep set of hallucinations, I think is really important to kind of grapple with here. Because everybody has like it's very important, I think, to our reading of this movie that Kiefer Sutherland and Kevin Bacon's characters have mirrored encounters when they flatline. They both wronged someone desperately in their childhood, and their responses to how they kind of try and redress the wounds that they've caused. And I think that contrasts, because that creates another, like, you know, dichotomous pair then, right? That pair is Julia Roberts' character and Hurley Baldwin's character, which I think also have like these familial problems that they have to deal with, you know, that again like branch off in two completely different directions.
Oh, his is mommy issues for sure. When they go into his situation, it does become sexual, but it starts out very maternal and then moves into the sexual, and he remarks on it when he wakes up and he says it wasn't like the usual thing that I do. Basically, he said it wasn't like the usual thing that I do. It was nurturing and caring, and I felt like I was being guided by a feminine spirit, and it's like, fuck off.
Yeah. Like, once again, we found, as with Jason Voorhees, we found another man in a horror movie who needs a dummy mommy.
Yep.
Look, I don't make the rules, but I do enforce them. You do not let straight men flatline. It's just, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It says it on the door. We cannot let you into the club.
A happy jump scare from a young Hope Davis appearing in, which is really cool. I was just watching the interview with, can you fucking believe it? Her, Jeff Daniels, James Gandolfini, and Marsha Gay Harden doing the American stage debut of God of Carnage. And then there's a whole Charlie Rose interview with the four of them. And it is just like, I'm in love with all of them. Like, I'm deeply, passionately in love with those four people specifically because, just amazing. Sorry, I just love Hope Davis.
Beautiful. Well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about what happens when you flatline. Let's talk about healing your childhood traumas, because that's what going beyond life is. That's what dying is. It's a chance to. Okay, so I'm gonna have to do it. There's a thing in The Principle of Hope where Bloch talks about like the opposite of hope is not fear. The opposite of hope is nostalgia, or rather, like, to be more specific, memory. Because if hope is the philosophy of the future, memory is that which kind of traps you backwards. It's a backward projection of subjectivity into something wherein you have no agency. That's why memory can often be very scary, right? Because there's nothing you can do except like live in it, and it has to be kind of like reintegrated into your sense of self. I don't know. I don't know if I have anything else to say, but it's like I don't know if there's many other horror movies that make that do it in this way and make memory the source of fear.
Yeah, I can't think of any, and I especially can't think of any that grapple with it in the under the sort of same conditions, right? This idea that like memory imposes itself, but always within its own fractured context. That's why memory mm-hmm. is really useful for fascism, right? Like this idea that it can be reconstructed and used with aims, which is sort of the, it's a dangerous game because there's an inverse political point. There's a mirrored political point of that too, which is the idea like weaponizing left-wing melancholia in the kind of the Enzo Traverso, Wendy Brown sort of conversation around, at least for Traverso, like critical theory in its capacity for not being to overcome the burden of the political memory on the left in the 20th century, which is like stupefying and almost funny enough, we're talking about filage, anesthetizing in a way that forecloses, in this case, we're talking about Block, would indeed foreclose hope.
Oh,
I think.
Good Lord. I just thought that this, if this line of thought kind of like holds true, there is a horror text that comes out the very same year as Flatliners, which is, mm-hmm. which is like orthogonal and related. And that's, the miniseries adaptation of Stephen King's It.
Yes.
Which we've talked about on the show before. We've talked about that back in the day. But it's like
I was gonna say like I think that is a really good orthogonal point to draw here because we're talking about like memory in a left political context, right? And both of these texts are about how we resolve the kind of lived experience of history, which is strongly woven into memory, right? And about the kind of like if we do take like. You know, like the God, there's so much to say. We're not going to make this a conversation about It, I promise, even though we're about to. But like in It, right? Like they like what happens to memory, right? It becomes resolved by people coming together as a community and rendering memory into what it actually is, and that's material relationships. And then what we have here in Flatliners is Nelson, David, and Rachel all kind of materially resolve, right, aspects of their memory that the flatlining experience is bringing them back to, right? Points where in David and Nelson's case, they desperately wrong someone, and in Rachel's case, where her misunderstanding of the full complexities of a situation she was just simply not old enough to understand caused a major rift in her heart and in her family. But then you've got Hurley on the other side, and right, you know, like I think the movie is not kind to Hurley. The movie's not kind to the resolution of his character, right? Like, because we're you know, everybody else atones, he pays, and I think he pays because he refuses to do what is materially necessary to engage with that memory to make it something more than this kind of like I don't know, like the kind of like right wing nostalgic problem that is like too malleable to be left.
Yeah, there's another sort of like lateral film here, and that is, I would think, much more decidedly right-wing interpretation, which is Clint Eastwood's Mystic River, which I think does a similar kind of thing with the sort of the idea of like the branches that spur off of childhood and how that's dealt with. You know, from like the childhood event, I guess, in this case, and how that's dealt with a community of people. And then the answers for Eastwood, as they usually are, pretty bleak. Hold your loved ones close, kind of typical conservative fare, which is still, it's interesting because I think this is all very important because that's still a common thread in right-wing media. That's how like it undergirds the like entire premise of Yellowstone, It's what Yellowstone is about, holding your family close, and if your family is also represented by property. And like, it's like, it's not, it's a diagonal, like Taylor Sheridan has all of these kind of like diagonalist like views, in that he's very, very defensive over the rights of indigenous people as well, because he grew up in West Texas. So he has these kind of like, but his interpretation of that is, if you just kind of minus all of the like Jacksonian masculinity that powers most of conservative culture still, there'll be a turn. They're going to make a biopic about Andrew Jackson here soon. It's going to happen. But in, yeah, it's going to be interesting. But then take into consideration the ideas around property and mankind's capacity to do anything besides what you believe it's already done and been doing in some way, which is always this very sort of like, you know, kill or be killed, dog eat dog. You know, no more lateral points, but Craig Zoller does this kind of too. From the right wing perspective, he has this like, he has the same perspective on how history functions, I think, and it's a conservative one and a bleak one, not one that's directed by kind of very passionate. No, I'm dumping out of that last point. I'll pretend that sentence didn't happen.
But like to tie together what you're saying, right? Like, if death is like the ultimate horizon of subjectivity and consciousness, then like political positionality means that you respond to those two things in two different ways, right? So to what you were saying, Kyle, death is the ultimate limit, right? And is something quite, there's something quite kind of deeply Americanly Protestant in that response of like, you will be alone before God, and that's like bleak and terrifying. So hold on to what you have right now, because ultimately, no matter what you do, no matter how much power you accumulate, you're still going to die, and you're still going to have to deal with the horrifying kind of emptiness of the beyond. Whereas in this film, and in some ways in something like It as well, like, history becomes both an archive and a weapon. Right, you can go backwards into your own like the own material, the stuff of your own material history, and all of those non-material aspects of like shame and confusion and like doubt and grief and guilt, all of those can be kind of like re-excavated through what they keep insisting on telling us in this movie is a distinctly materialist process. Right, we're not doing like childhood therapy or like, you know, having like a vision quest. Mm-hmm. We're doing medicine and science, guys. We're just doing medicine. We're just doing science, and coincidentally, through this like distinctly materialist, physicalist engagement with the world, you end up kind of creating this, sense of historical continuity that is a richer conception of historical materialism.
Okay, cool. I'm gonna cash in. This is Ash's orthogonal point of the day. Because do you want to know what Flatliners really is at its core? Is gay goth Twister, the Michael Crichton movie? Because I think John, you were so incredibly right here. Because in what we see in Twister, right, is, you know, like kind of, it's the same shape as Flatliners, right? We have this emergence of the complicated force of the divine. In this case, it's the boundary between life and death. And in the case of Twister, it's a goddamn twister. And what are our cast of characters trying to do? They're attempting to levy like this materialist understanding on these forces. But what the movie winds up being, at least for me, is so much more strongly about not the kind of nuts and bolts of the, oh, like we're going to understand the infinite complexity of the divine through assaulting this kind of like liminal barrier with a power that humanity can barely reckon, and much more how each of our characters orient themselves towards that. and then how we can kind of build left discussions out of those orientations. HV episode on Twister and the Twister's reboot, spinoff, sequel coming to a podcast near you.
I'd watch the shit out of Twister. Honestly, I just got really excited about Twister. There's a ride at Universal.
Yeah, baby.
For Twister, the Universal in Orlando. And our favorite part was always when the cow comes by because it's very clear strings. We'd always, we're like, okay, you have to clap for the cow. And that's what our group would always, usually on a church trip or whatever, but we were pretty funny. And we thought it was fun to applause for the cow, for the cow.
As I've been in a few Twisters, and I would love to do a Twister episode. Let's get into the dark, twisted corners of our mind and discuss Twisters.
The bow with the bow sample goes there.
Honestly, we could do.
We are not giving Kid Rock royalties.
Yeah, we could do a whole like sub show on just the cinema of the 1990s.
Really, really, the 90s fucked in ways that I think we're attempting to learn again.
Well, they got one over on those baby boomers.
Oh my god. Let's talk about the time where Michael Crichton flatlined and got in touch with like the future spirit of all digital culture.
Yeah, they really I loved that point. I loved that point. I loved it. Just add another sort of like strange like vehicle for our, like, it's baggage in like the sense of the term, like all of this, like this movie is about baggage. It's about baggage is stuff that you carry other stuff in. So it's not just about the problems, mm-hmm. but it's the fact that it's the way that you hold the problems, right? And so being obsessed with generational conflict is a, you know, not just probably like, not to be crude, but some pressure release valve that dissuades from things like class conflict. But even more to take the purposefully like complex route, if it's a vehicle for trauma that you carry with you in a burdensome fashion, accepting the metaphor at its face value, then this like constant drive toward this like sort of placing that in the context of a generational conflict. I lost my train of thought.
I'll catch this ball before it hits the ground. Like
alley-oop.
I think you're spot on with this conflict, right? With how we approach generational conflict. Because again, what has ever been the boss's trick has been to subdivide the working class with new little oppressive baubles. Right, you know, right when we start to unify, they'll throw in race, they'll throw in gender, they'll throw in sexual orientation, whatever they got to get us to turn on each other, rather than seeing the obvious common material unity that we share. And what I find really interesting about this is an extremely Gen X movie, right? And when I say that, I mean like out of a lot of Gen X media, there is a media response, more importantly, because listeners, you know, if there's one thing that is baggage that both contains and is the container. For everything, wait, contains and is the container is redundant. You know what I wanted to say, listeners. You know. This is parasocial. You can guess what I'm saying. Like
close personal like, friends. You know,
yeah, my close personal friends who hear this, with which I have intimate relationships, aka I don't think any of my friends listen to this podcast because now all my friends are on this podcast. Heyo. But no, like I think out of a lot of Gen X media and out of a lot of Gen X response to media, contemporary criticisms that Gen Xers were writing about the culture that they themselves were producing, you see this preoccupation with what we on the left would call the aura, right? This kind of authenticity in a work of art. Is something authentic or is it the product of a machine, right? Like a very classic example of what we could take from punk rock, right? Is that real punk rock or is that just kind of sellout poser shit? And the same conversations have been had about metal. The same conversations have been had about essentially every genre, some way more so than others. And I think in here, we're seeing that conversation played out really writ large from that perspective. And we're seeing that played out on these kind of spiritual gothic lines.
Oh, absolutely.
As a epistemology problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rockist versus poptimist question was never really an aesthetic one. It was an epistemological one. Right. Mm-hmm. It's never just about the music, man. Right. That's not what it's about. And you were right. There is this kind of like drive in this film so explicitly towards this notion of like the authentic experience. You have to try and get out of your head, quite literally. To have some sort of authentic experience. But really, all that happens is you're thrown back into your own sense of self, right? But this is the point in which you go out to return in some sort of more fulfilled way. But the whole point is, like, it's every generational argument. It's like, oh, the boomers sold out, right? That's what the line really reflects. It's like this idea of, like,
mm-hmm.
They stopped searching for this quote unquote authenticity, but in fact, the authenticity that they're after is like to become more like the person that they already are. It's to like unify.
Yes.
It's to unify that sense of self trans-historically. That's what it means to become authentic.
And like something that really stands out to me in the context of the conversation we're having is that like, The insult boomer doesn't always reflect the literal boomer. That's often applied to Gen X, you know, and if there's anything more damning than kind of that like dehistoricized, anti-intellectual, like amaterial approach to aura that a lot of Gen X art and art commentary forwarded, is that like they now wear the label that they loathed so much. They are now the boomer, right? I think part of this too is like I have friends who are as myself a millennial, if these distinctions are to mean anything, these kind of like generational terms, like, and I watch so many of my friends, you know, be like, oh, we'll never sell out like those generations before us, you know, we will retain some kind of, you know, abstract sense of purity in our politics and our position. And I am just like, you know, like you millennials, Gen Z, Gen A, woe to you, O earth and sea. Like this is going to happen, you know, without the kind of like historicized intellectual material analysis of the things behind generational positions and how they relate to class. You know, we wind up kind of just repeating what happens to Joe Hurley here. We just suffer loss when everyone else around us is achieving atonement by actually doing these things.
I mean, I think you can see quite clearly in that moment that like the thing that Gen X hated about the boomers was the boomers' sincerity, right? Mm-hmm. Like Gen X, like you watch this movie and you'll see it. Like the young Gen X is like, is cynical, is cool. They don't believe in your rules. This is the whole inciting incident for Kevin Bacon's character. He's like, I've been suspended for a term. I'm leaving. Why?
He jumps out a window.
which is fucking cool. Out of a window. But it's
we have to pause. That is cool as fuck.
Yeah, he just rappels.
He just rappels.
I can't. Stairs are establishment.
Look, yes, there's this amazing.
There's this amazing essay on Hitchcock's cinema and homosexuality called Anal Rope. And I want you to read that essay and then watch that scene with Kevin Bacon and allow yourself to explore the connection between Sutherland and Bacon's characters.
But like, yeah, that but rules. You know, the Gen Xers were like the kind of cool, cynical, disaffected. And it's like they're the ones mm-hmm. who like make a big deal of them being atheists or like Kiefer Sutherland's, where they're like, no, we're finally going to solve the problem by becoming even more like avowedly positivistic in our scientific epistemologies. Whereas the boomers were loathed because they'd accepted quite a lot. You know, they'd gone through the boom time of like the post-war consensus. They'd done very well. They'd secured the gains of American capitalism on the backs of everybody else. And I think it's really interesting, Ash, that you brought up millennials, because like sociologically, like people are already talking about the fact that like millennials are going to be due for like massive transfers of property. And obviously that's going to be striated by like race and class, but like
yes,
all of those things that you talked about are going to happen, right? The sellout is like the chronos, the countdown to the sellout is already on.
And this is something, yeah, Kyle, please take it away.
No, I just wanted to say that I find interesting that now all of this is indebted to this increasingly loud cultural feedback loop that is now doing a lot of the articulating. So it's even less about things that actually happened and more about articulating within the realm, like staring straight into the realm of culture. And now what's happening is speaking of categories, all the millennials grown at the same time. There is currently an indie sleaze, as they're calling it, revival, which is indie sleaze is what people used to derisively call hipster, which is basically the mid to late aughts, basically ending around 2010, 2012. I saw someone frame it, I think yesterday, that it ended with the release of Macklemore's Thrift Shop, which I think is actually a very good way of looking at it.
Yes, agreed.
That is when none of that aesthetic was very cool anymore. Well, it's already experiencing a kind of revival that is being mapped onto that same idea of conflict. Millennials are too idealistic, hopeful, too positive and happy and thus cringy. And Zoomer, Generation Z, are more sort of like detached, are questioning certain sort of like the legitimacy of certain institutions, both from like left wing and right wing perspectives, yes, and all of this stuff. And then there's the unknowable next generation that just watches Skibidi Toilet. and so there's this like all of this stuff is playing out in the exact same way that it pretty much always does, but it's just more indebted to the thing that we do all the time now, which is stare at our phones. So it's more about that language rather than the language from the 90s.
The emo revival, like that My Chemical Romance went back on tour. The Batman came out, where he basically sings brand new songs in his car. we went through the emo revival, which was like very, which was about kind of like feeling. It was about the deep yearning emotion of it all. And so it's not a surprise that we're back in the kind of like just sort of like depressing hedonia of indie sleaze, which was like grim the first time around.
Yes.
And I think this is really appropriate too, because even like kind of like the really early days of emo music, like this is a direct alchemic backlash to the kind of disaffective, distanced cynicism that came out of a lot of like, you know, the music that we would consider today to be like, you know, like the hits of Gen X. You know, like we trade then this kind of distance for this hyper sincerity. And then like, of course, the backlash continues again, but it gets washed one more time, right? It comes back as like this weird kind of farcical reimagining. Kyle, you're... Oh, go on, please.
No, please. I want to hear what you have to say.
Save me from me.
Rather than the sound of my own voice, yeah.
No, but the sound of your own voice is fucking soothing, Kyle. Let's not lose sight of the value add that we just got on our show here. But no, like, I think connecting this to smartphones is really interesting, right? Because, you know, like, I can't help but think of... Because there was that recent Flatliners remake that wasn't too recent. I think that was pre-COVID. That was like, what, 2017? Something like that?
Yeah.
And, like, I can't help but think that the post-COVID Flatliners movie would be like a live stream experience, right? Would be let's live stream flatlining. You know, let's reduce as much as we can a kind of divine experience to something we could like put on an app, right? Like sum it down to the device that we hold in our hands always, forever, and eternally. And I think it's really important to kind of like dwell on the fact that like, Kyle, your point here is like so salient that like a lot of the experiences that show up in Schumacher's Flatliners necessarily happen because there is a slowness, right? There's like this decelerated cultural speed and stuff takes a lot more time. You know, everyone is not automatically always in reach of each other, and there's not that kind of perception of like, oh, because everyone is always immediately in reach of each other, we are permanently forever beholden to that. And if someone elects to not reply or take time, or like, that is seen as a slight, right? That is seen as an act of aggression in and of itself. And I think that there's something really compelling to like bring this analysis outward. And when you mentioned like, oh, we're staring straight into culture, like the first thing that happened in my mind is like, no, we need to be staring gaily into culture.
Yeah, I mean, there's this, the real arc that y'all were describing is like, it's summed up as it usually is. You go to hip hop to find, you know, the first changes in culture. And just to kind of bookend the moments that we were just talking about, the contemporary mm-hmm. moments that we're talking about, of which the 2017 Flatliners came in around the about in the middle. Lil Uzi Vert put out Exo Tour Life a couple of years before that. That's Push mm-hmm. Me to the Edge, All My Friends Are Dead. The real sort of like pickup of it. And then Lil Uzi Vert, a few years later, starts wearing Slipknot t-shirts live. And that's when the mall goth sort of revival stuff, which was the really the introduction into this sort of new like turn back toward the away from sincerity, if you will. And now one of the biggest there was a collaboration that was released between this duo from Detroit, I think, called the Snow Steppers and Lil Uzi Vert. Last year, Snowsteppers are frequently cited as one of the biggest indie sleaze acts. They're sort of like, they sound like, it's Crystal Castles. They sound like Crystal Castles.
Oh, okay.
It's Crystal Castles. And they're on Uzi's most recent record, as well, and came back for another collaboration on another song. I think we nailed it, because there's your evidence right there.
And I mean, like that cultural pattern that you're evoking right there, like even predates the discourses that we're like, you know, having it through, right? Like who is disco? You know, like who is the forefront of disco music? People of color and queer people. Right, like that is who forged disco. And again, like, you know, part of the flow of like cultural dialogue we have that's often left out of these equations, when people like say things like, oh, like disco fucking sucks, like what's actually being sublimated there is racism and homophobia. Mm-hmm. You know, and like those same dialogues kind of radiate forward and radiate outward, Kyle, because Kyle, I think your point is dead on here.
Disco's back, by the way. All the pop songs sound like disco now.
Mm-hmm,
Like no war, but the class war sounds like a, like, because this generational, I think Ash, you were the one who pointed this out, that this generational, these intergenerational antagonisms are like sublimations and like dispersals of like class antagonisms. Boris Groyd talks about horizontal versus vertical mm-hmm. solidarity. And like, it's very easy to create vertical solidarity where you relate to people generationally, because like, oh, the same, like your boss is a millennial like you. So it's mm-hmm, fine mm-hmm. that they use passive aggressive therapy speak to make you work in hours and conditions that would violate your contract. That's fine. Whereas like horizontal solidarity is actually much harder to create, because that's class-based solidarity.
Yes.
So I guess the kind of point is like, the question that this brings me to, I think, that I'm curious about is like, what is the flow? If our kind of cool, cynical Gen Xers flatline, find out their kind of like guilt and shame and grief at coming of age as a particular moment of like American history, what does flatlining look like now for us, for people listening? What's millennial flatlining? What do you find if you go, what do you find if you kind of like are willing to, because like obviously the death is metaphoric, right? This it's a medicalized metaphor for a certain kind of like subjective experience. So it's like, what, and this isn't necessarily to go back to the old things of like ego death or destroying the self or like any of that, But I am curious to know what you both think of, like, what does it look like for there to be like millennial flatlining? Also, so hello, I think hello to the most perfect cat in the world. Hello.
Otis has dropped by the podcast to say hello to Horror Vanguard.
Guest star Otis. If only Otis could share with us his wisdom and insight. But no, like, so I think you said like the magic word. You said ego death, right?
And like, yeah, that was my trap like card for you. That was my trap card for you.
God, I am so easily baited. This isn't funny. I would be terrible in like debate class or something. I did mock trial and got kicked out for cheating. And by cheating, I mean I did research outside of what the documents and packets we were given. So thank you very little. But no, yeah, baited, trapped, got me. Thank you, Yugi. But like, so like we're in kind of like this interesting cultural moment, I think, where like, you know, the kind of psychedelic experience of ego death, right? Like really and truly dissolving the boundaries of the ego and experiencing the like genuine and magnificent interconnectedness of all life is something that Silicon Valley executives pay for other white people who have like servants in a rented compound in Central America to do for them. You know, it's mediated by capital. It's mediated by technology. You can now purchase the experience of ego death. And there's this great meme that I keep going back to. And it's like a guy in a business suit surrounded by like psychedelic graphics. And he's like, oh, I've experienced ego death. And like, now I know that it's moral for me to make an app that charge your mom for breathing. And like, I think that's the kind of problem of the millennial experience for flatlining. Right, is that like if flatlining existed today, it would not take this known form, right? Because this movie is very psychedelic, right? You know, like these people are using like they're mediating contact with the divine through medical technology, and that's literally just dropping acid. Like all they're doing is dropping acid, but with much greater risk to your health and well-being. Kiefer Sutherland is in Chicago, and like when they're filming this movie, and these people don't have access to psychedelics, I'm deeply confused. But I think that is kind of part of the problem because our technological mediation of that has now been like washed through the rentier economy. So like today, like we have to find the new exits, right? We have to find the new flatlinings because all of the old flatlinings have been rented back out to us.
Yeah, you can flatline for a low monthly fee of $35. Where someone comes to your house and fucking kills you. And that's the only
that's what you get if you sign up for a Twitter blue check mark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean I'm
Oh, I'm so sorry. You didn't pay for Flatline Premium. You got Flatline Basic. So your wife is gonna divorce you, but you can keep the sexual assault tapes you've made and you don't have to do any healing for that. Your friend's got the premium subscription, so actually the ghost of the boy he killed as a child will forgive him.
yeah, you're not going to get a hug from your dad. I know you really need it, but unfortunately.
That's the ultra premium package, as you see the ghost of your dad is like, it's okay, it was my fault.
Yeah. Please forgive me, I'm sorry. I mean, I think people are still trying to figure this out, right? There's, on the one hand, there's this kind of, there's an implicit understanding of the fundamental like imbalance in institutions and maybe a fundamental mistrust of those institutions themselves. But this either necessary ideological recapitulation toward those institutions in a way that's just like, if I just be super, super positive, Pete Buttigieg can really, really help me out. Or like he can, you know, make my plane tickets home cheaper or whatever. And then on the other hand, you have this kind of like, I don't know, like, I guess the politics of destituency, as this kind of like grasp toward, an outside, which I'm in some ways like inclined toward specifically because of its historical functions in the way that it from incidents of the most planned to the most spontaneous, it has residue, of some kind of, constellation that is just about sort of like opposition to capital. And through that, I believe there's an articulation of some kind of like exterior. But the other problem is that everyone else is just like, I'll just go get some chickens. And if I can homestead my way.
Yeah, you can homestead your way out of the annihilation of capitalism.
Yeah.
Which, yeah.
I'm going to start a commune, but like I don't actually talk to the people I'm close to. Like somehow those magics are going to work together.
I am totally with you. And it was a kind of like slightly loaded question, because I think, to put it in the theological language, it's about dying to self, right? And again, that's often kind of posited as a kind of like proto-psychedelia, and I think that's true. But it's also about this idea of moving beyond atomized lonely subjectivity. It is like flatlining in the, like as a metaphor, I think this is a really good way of thinking about what does it mean to like become or go beyond the limits of our own individual atomized subjectivity. And that experience of flatlining is only possible through the collaborative effort and hard work and appropriations of external forces of a group of people. Mm-hmm. Right, there's a sort of like militancy to them, right? There's a sort of like militant collectivity.
Yes.
They exist in a sort of undercommon space within this educational and societal institution where they steal what they need to have this kind of like collective group experience. And I think this is a really good metaphor for the condition of the situation of contemporary class consciousness, right?
Yes. Oh my God, yes. keep going.
Like, I've been thinking a lot about like Fred Moten's idea of the undercommons and this like being both within and against, which is entirely in keeping with what you're talking about, Kyle, and like constituent communism and this idea of what is our capacity? What is within our capacity? And to what degree do we have agency to like pry open those fracture points? And again, this is all very Blockian and Benjaminian, because it's about understanding that the great problem is to like accept the pseudo naturalization of the current state of things, right? That's the very opposite of flatlining, right? This is a really good way. The only way out is out together, and that is done by like taking what you need and like depending upon those who have acquired the skills that you need to survive. Sorry, go on, Ash.
No, I'm so hyped by what we're getting to here, and that's I think God, there's like, okay, so there's two things I want to say, and one's like much more of a point than the other one, but like, so I think one of the really interesting things we see in this movie is exactly what we're talking about here with like dissentient communism and all of this stuff, because like at the early onset of the psychedelic movement here in the States, the whole idea was dropping out, right? It was negating the horrors of the world in which we find ourselves. But that kind of approach to like a creation of a politics makes you inexorably bound to the thing you're trying to negate, right? I am not that thing means that thing has to be with you forever because you aren't anything. And then by the time we get to today, it's very much dropping in, right? Psychedelics are no longer a way out. They're a way to work better, right? You use microdose LSD to manage your stress so you can get back to the office. And then once you get high enough in the ranks of the office, you can take larger doses of LSD, which will give you cool ideas for future apps. But I think it's missing the kind of like, you know, like next stage of evolution, right? It's missing the point, right? That the absolute, that kind of like undercommons, this idea of a resistance from within, and these things that we see happening here in Flatliners. And I think there's a good sequence that actually like really illustrates this point. And it's a scene that I found to be really interesting in this last watch I had, where so we've got Julia Roberts, like all of our characters bid for how long they're going to spend flatlining, how long they're going to spend dead. And the person who's got the highest bid, they get to go next. Right. That's kind of the informal system they've made to decide who goes next. You wager with your life and you get the next turn. And then everybody who wants to go has gone. And now it's Julia Roberts' character. It's her turn. And she's like, OK, I'm going to go. I'll go for whatever, 2 minutes. And then, you know, like Kiefer Sutherland and Kevin Bacon and everybody else are like, 5 minutes. You know, they start outbidding her. or sorry, Kiefer Sutherland starts outbidding her, right? But then you see, like, all of these other, like, guys, like, you know, like, all these other, like, obviously, like, cis, probably very gay dudes. What besides one of them, besides Hurley? Hurley, you're not gay. Like they show solidarity across gender lines, right? Like, they say, like, hey, like, we're destroying this project and we're exiting it, like, if she doesn't get her proper turn, regardless of our, like, previous, like, temporal betting system. And I think that really illustrates, like, a couple of the points we've been weaving here, right, of, like, actually creating these material solidarities across oppressive lines.
I'm desperately searching the internet. I can't find it for that meme that's supposed to be the tech billionaire on his ayahuasca vision quest. Yes. Or whatever. And he has his legs crossed and it has a bunch of really shitty ideas all around him. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like Uber for your dog or whatever.
Yep. Yep.
That's the kind of problem that we're running into. And I think John very neatly described, especially something of a solution. There's a problem, like the problem of alienation and surplus extraction are not impersonal. They're very personal. The changes to the fundamental life processes, as Marx describes it, as the means for the absorption of the labor of others, I believe is how he describes it, which is it affirms this kind of really intense function of the material as an alteration of social life that's only accelerated during capitalism. You can be the most like hyper economic dispensationalist in the world and be critical of a whole bunch of other, you know, aspects of Marx, and that remains true. That remains true for conservative economists. The changes in everyday life processes through things like the change and alteration of time and workplace structure, and like all the way down to laws against things like vagrancy, which all stem from like English law about idleness and labor. So there's this really, the Marxist critique is like the solution for this, is the too long didn't read. And the Marxist critique solves this problem of trying to mediate these things in others, so across these other various planes. But the Marxist critique brings it all into this like sort of line that makes interpretation possible even now.
So we have gone long on today's conversation. Do we have any parting thoughts as I ready the next syringe of sodium pentothal? Kyle, I'm handing you the freeze your body comfort blanket.
I'm very slowly falling asleep and getting visions of my inner child being bullied. I guess my advice to everybody is be careful when you're in a tree. Pet your dog. Yeah. I think this is
another in the we're putting you in the device movie genre. Yeah. but in this case, it's like I'm willingly making you put me into the device. Please
the device.
This is rack kink. Please put me in the device. This is risk aware consensual kink.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just came out of flatlining, and
we hope
God
you've enjoyed
told me
the dread
there's a
discourse.
New world struggling to be
Until
born.
Next week, stay spooky.
Oh my God, that's perfect. We got to end it with that. That's great. That's fucking great.